Today's guest is someone you've heard a lot about over the past 2 years, George Papadopoulos, who was a foreign policy advisor to Donald Trump's presidential campaign. His new book, Deep State Target, How I Got Caught in the Crosshairs of the Plot to Bring Down President Trump, is the only firsthand account that proves the attempted sabotage of Donald Trump's presidential campaign by intelligence agencies. George, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
There are a lot of people who have not followed the story of your involvement in the Russian collusion hoax very closely, so I want to avoid any presumption of knowledge on the part of our listeners and take this one step at a time. So let's start at the beginning. Who is the London Center for International Law Practice, and why did they hire you? What was your position there, and why did you leave? Give us the whole story.
I guess let me go back in time a little, even before that, so we could give some context into how this company approached me and why. From 2011 to 2015, I had been working as a research associate at the Hudson Institute. It's a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C., where I had been working on energy policy questions in the Middle East and in the Mediterranean. Fast forward to the summer of 2015, there's obviously a presidential campaign season underway, and I reach out to Corey Lewandowski, and I tell him I want to leave my job here at Hudson and join the campaign because I think you have a winner. Corey and I stay in touch. I end up leaving Hudson Institute and go to London, where I'm working in at an energy consultancy group called Energy Stream. Out of the blue, in November of 2015, as I'm in touch with the Ben Carson campaign to join them, I get an invite on LinkedIn from this company named the London Center for International Law Practice. And they say, would you like to come meet with us and discuss you joining our organization as a director, as for, I think it was their energy director or something along those lines, which never really made sense to me. So I go there, and within 48 hours, they tell me, you're great. We want to make you a director here. And I started to look at some of the other people there and, you know, who they were affiliated with and what their accolades were. And either they were former diplomats in Western governments, or, you know, prominent attorneys around the world, or they were tied into Western intelligence services, including the FBI, the MI6, the CIA. So I, you know, I had worked in these types of circles in the past. I wasn't, you know, too weary about it initially. So I get there, and I just really never quite understood what my job was supposed to do, except to put me in the room with certain high-profile people in the energy sector in the UK and other governments. So it's at that point when I officially joined the Ben Carson campaign, and I tell this company, look, it was a pleasure to meet you, but I have to leave because I'm joining the Ben Carson campaign now. And as soon as that happened, that's when I had my first overture by the CIA in London as well. So all of this, I don't think, was a coincidence as I was joining the Ben Carson campaign.
What kind of overture did the CIA make to you?
So this person, who anybody, any listener to this program right now can Google him, and you could see who the person is. His name is David Kovich. I was speaking at a energy conference in London around the time when this London Center for International Law Practice reached out to me. And I get a contact from him, from this David Kovich person. He runs the energy department at the U.S. Embassy in London to this day. And obviously that's a cover for the CIA. And he says, you know, I heard your speech and I'm hearing you're joining the Carson campaign. Can you come to the embassy and talk with me? So I go to the embassy and he starts to introduce me to some of his colleagues there. And they're probing me about two very disparate things, which became a theme moving forward. One, what were my professional and business ties in Europe and in the Middle East? And the second, what the Ben Carson campaign was really all about and what he was planning on doing as a candidate. So that's what that initial, why my suspicions have been heightened, looking back, of course, because no one understood in 2015 and 2016 that the Obama administration was spying on rival candidates. And that's exactly what I think was happening, not only with the Donald Trump campaign, but probably even other campaigns as well, including the campaign I first worked on, and that was Ben Carson.
Yes, that whole thing sounds very suspicious. And as I understand it, when you told the London Center for International Law Practice that you were going to leave, they were doing cartwheels to get you to stay. I think they offered you a free 5-day vacation in Rome or something. What do you think that was?
Oh, so that's the reason I wanted to just provide some context for the listeners and you about this company and when they first reached out to me and under the suspicious circumstances. So after I leave the Ben Carson campaign in January of 2016, I go back to London where I was living full time, and they contact me and they say, well, you left Carson's campaign. Would you like to come back and work here? And at that point, you know, I was just doing various consulting gigs, and I really didn't understand what this company wanted from me, considering we had no plan for what I was supposed to do, except obviously just be there to be monitored. That's what at least it seems like now. And then Corey Lewandowski from Trump's campaign contacts me about 3 weeks after I get back to London, and he says, look, George, we're finally going to expand the team, and we'd like for you to join. And I said, that's great. So I tell this company, the London Center for International Law Practice, I'm leaving again, except this time I'm permanently moving back to the U.S., and I'm not going to be working here anymore. And they were furious. And they said, well, you know, why don't you meet some people, and before you go, they might be helpful for you on the Trump campaign. And that's when, this is the pivotal moment in this entire Spygate story, a woman named Arvinder Sambe, who was a director at this company, who also was a FBI legal attaché, and she knew Bob Mueller personally, something I didn't know, of course, at the time. She tells me to go to Rome, and that's where I meet Joseph Mifsud. Trying to simplify it, but it's a very intrinsic, complicated story with a lot of characters, so I'm just trying to make sure that the listeners could follow it step by step, because the chronology is very important.
Speaking of chronology, another thing we should get out of the way is, once and for all, do you have any contacts in Russia, and have you ever had any contacts in Russia?
I've never been to Russia. I've never met a Russian official in my entire life, let alone on the Trump campaign or Trump transition team. And the last thing I'll say about Russia is, somebody who worked at a neoconservative think tank the way I did and was in the energy business as an American, the last thing you're doing is promoting Russian interests. So how I fell into this bizarre Russia conspiracy, when that's my background, you could just understand how incredible this PSYOP was against the American people.
So you've never been to Russia, kind of the same deal as the false assertion that Michael Cohen was in Prague. You have to wonder who comes up with these stories.
Well, that's what this that's why this story is so fascinating, because it's a counterintelligence story that obviously was perpetrated by seasoned operatives from the West in order to make it look like people like myself, Michael Cohen, Michael Flynn, Carter Page, others on the campaign, and even Trump himself were Russian agents, simply for the fact that in some cases, some people had traveled and had done business in Russia, like Carter Page or Michael Flynn, or others like myself who were clearly just entrapped by people masquerading as Russians when they were just operatives working with either the FBI or the CIA.
All right, this brings us to the most mysterious player in all of this, a Maltese professor by the name of Joseph Mifsud. Now, first of all, and let's take this real slow, because I think this really confuses people. First, how did you come to meet him? And second, what do you now believe was his role in all this? Was he a Russian agent, or was he an asset of some intelligence agency?
Great question. So the lady that was a director at the company I used to work for, Arvinder Sambe, who was connected to the FBI, and she also knew Bob Mueller personally. This is something I didn't know at the time. When I said I was leaving the company and they were furious, they said, before you go,
right,
why don't you come to Rome with us on a business trip so that we can introduce you to some people who are going to help you on the Trump campaign? So I said to myself, well, if they're going to pay for me to go to Rome for a couple of days, I've never been to Rome. It's kind of like a nice paid vacation. And that's the logic I took, because why would a company, after you're telling them you're leaving them, would pay for you to fly with them to do a business trip? So anyway, I go to Rome to this school called Link Campus. And immediately upon going to this school there, I knew it wasn't an ordinary university, because you had Italian high-level politicians working there. You had government officials from America there talking at panels, and you could just understand it was basically like a Georgetown of Italy, or more likely a Quantico, meaning a spy school of some nature. And that's exactly what it ended up being, because after I did my research into Link Campus, I found out that the CIA and the FBI trains there. So that's where I met Joseph Mifsud for the first time. And Joseph Mifsud was a professor at this school that the CIA and the FBI trains at. And then he somehow became a Russian intermediary in my life.
So he was teaching at the school in Italy, is that what you're saying?
Yes, he was a nominal professor, but he was also, it looks like, a spy working at this CIA-FBI school called Link Campus. And he also was a professor, a quote-unquote professor, in London as well. And he had an extensive network all around Europe and at the State Department, and even knew Hillary Clinton personally. So this is the character, just for a little background of the for the people listening, of who Joseph Mifsud is and why I felt it was so strange that a person who was aligned with Hillary Clinton, was connected to the MI6, the CIA, the FBI, taught in Rome, taught in London, all of a sudden was trying to set up a meeting between myself and Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. It never made sense until you look at it through a setup, and that's exactly what it was.
So you don't think he was a Russian agent. It sounds like you think he was an asset of some intelligence agency.
Yes. The information we have now, and that's why it's such a pleasure to talk to you now with some incredible information that's been coming out recently, is the following. Two things. Just yesterday in Italy, it came out that Joseph Mifsud was working undercover when he was meeting with me in Rome. And the second thing is that he was prodded to basically entrap me and to tell me that he was a Russian intermediary by the former Italian foreign minister. Now, just to be clear, I'm an American citizen and I'm a campaign advisor for probably the next president at that time. No foreign government, let alone the Italian government, is going to do any funny business with me unless the American government is telling them to do it. And that's exactly why I think this person, who you might start hearing a lot more about moving forward as the IG report comes out next week, Michael Gaeta, is going to be very important, because he was the FBI's liaison in Rome, and there's speculation that he was actually handling Joseph Mifsud when he was in discussions with me.
Okay, so Robert Mueller's report stated that Mifsud told you that the Russians had dirt on Hillary Clinton in the form of emails. So I want to know from you if you think, if that is true, because I believe Mifsud denied that he told you this, right?
Yeah, well, here's why that's very strange. Just so we see, so on April 26th, he tells me this openly, that the Russians have Hillary Clinton's emails, okay? He never said DNC, he never said Podesta. And why is this important? At that time, in the beginning of May and around late April, when Mifsud told me this information, you had people like Judge Andrew Napolitano going on Fox News openly speculating and discussing the Russians having Hillary Clinton's emails. You could simply look on YouTube and you'll see the video I'm talking about. It's on May 5th and on May 9th, 2016, where Andrew Napolitano is discussing this. So when Joseph Mifsud told me this information, I never felt that it was anything but him validating a rumor that people had been openly discussing for months around the world about Hillary Clinton's private sector server being hacked. So how did that information lead him to become a Russian cutout or a Russian middleman when other people were discussing it openly? I have no idea.
And he denied that he told you that he had Hillary Clinton emails, right?
Well, I think he denied it, I think that's a good point you made, but I think the reason he denied it is not because he's just saying I'm lying, because he did say it to me, but I think he's denying it because now that he's under investigation in Italy, and Devin Nunes and the President of the United States himself are pressuring the Italian government to give this guy up and to start talking about what he was really up to, if it's indeed proven that the FBI was running this guy to entrap me with information like that that I never wanted, that's serious trouble for the FBI. And I'm pretty sure that's why Mifsud has disappeared and why he has made some statement where he said, I never said that to George.
And speaking of him disappearing, that's the most mysterious thing of all. Do you know if anyone has any idea where he is today?
That's a great question. And just in the last couple of weeks, we have discovered that he's been living in Italy. And that's why Devin Nunes last week and President Trump called the Italian prime minister to get more info on him. Because my wife, she's Italian, and she reads the papers over there. And because this isn't being covered at all in the mainstream media in America. So I went on Fox and Friends, I think the day after this bombshell article came out that said that Mifsud's in Italy. And I said it. And then President Trump called the Italian prime minister. And now there's this massive snowball effect that's taking place where people are trying to actually get him to start talking and possibly even testify to U.S. investigators now that their new investigation's underway.
Now, as I understand it, Mifsud introduced you to his aide, a Russian woman by the name of Olga Polinskaya, whom he said was Vladimir Putin's niece. Why don't you tell us about your interactions with her?
Oh, wow. Okay, so I meet him, as I stated, at this CIA school after an FBI intermediary introduces me to him. And I go back to London, and he emails me out of the blue. And he says, why don't you come meet with me? I had a pleasure meeting you. I have a very important person for you to meet. And you're going to, you know, like meeting her. And I said, who is it? And she said, this is the niece of Vladimir Putin. And, you know, I started laughing initially because I didn't believe him. But so I go to my company, the London Center for International Law Practice, and I ask them, who is this person and who is he introducing me to? And the company, that the suspicious company that I was working for, told me, yeah, that's the niece of Vladimir Putin, and you need to go meet with him. So they were in on whatever this bizarre meeting was about, which I think was a setup. This, of course, Vladimir Putin has no siblings, so whoever this person was, it wasn't Vladimir Putin's niece. And, you know, I get there. He basically tells me she's going to act as your middlewoman between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. You know, she's very well connected in Russia, and if you need Donald Trump to meet President Putin, she's going to help you do it. And at that time, Donald Trump was very open about meeting Putin, so there was nothing problematic about it, until I later find out that this person, whoever she was just some wine store manager and was not the niece of anybody. So why he introduced me to her, I don't know, but people are speculating that she might have been some sort of informant as well.
It's a great, great movie so far. Let's move on. Alexander Downer, who was the Australian ambassador to the UK, now he purportedly said that his 2000 meeting with you was a setup, I think. I don't quite understand that. He claimed that you said Russia had dirt on Hillary Clinton, and you told him about your conversation with Mifsud. Is that true?
Okay, so I never – okay, let's look at the timeline again. After Joseph Mifsud – and this is why I think this entire thing was a setup and why even the president now calls it a setup too, especially regarding my case. After Joseph Mifsud tells me this information in late April, I'm approached by the DIA, which is the Defense Intelligence Agency in London, American guys, who start to probe me and question me. And I have the head of the UK government reach out to me right underneath the prime minister to talk with me. After these strange encounters, and now that we know that Peter Strzok's boss was in London the same week of May 6th, I get an unsolicited email from Alexander Downer to meet with him. And I had never heard of this person. This person, I Googled him. He was the former foreign minister of Australia. He had a very high-level position, so I didn't understand exactly why he wanted to meet with me. I get to this meeting, and just to be clear, I've testified about this meeting under oath. So what I'm telling you now is what I told Congressman Mark Meadows and John Ratcliffe. I felt that Alexander Downer was not a diplomat, but I think he was a spy. And I think he was sent to make contact with me and record particular aspects of our conversation and to take things out of context, perhaps. So I was talking with him about everything but the U.S.-Australia relationship. He wasn't there to understand the U.S.-Australia relationship. He wanted to know about Trump and everything about Trump. And somehow from this meeting, which I never spoke to him about Russia at all, he transmitted some information 3 months after the meeting saying to the FBI, oh, I think George Papadopoulos said that the Russians have dirt on Hillary, which was completely absurd. And if you just look at his background, you can see that he was a personal friend of Bill and Hillary Clinton. So, of course, he had a vested interest in a Clinton presidency. And, you know, I think next week when the president starts to declassify materials, his name is going to pop up again, and we're going to see exactly what his official role was. But he wasn't simply a diplomat. That I'm certain of.
And if I recall, he was vehemently anti-Trump, wasn't he?
Oh, incredibly anti-Trump. This was a person who, when he was the Australian foreign minister, donated $25 million of hard-earned Australian taxpayer money to the Clinton Foundation. He also was a personal friend of Hillary and Bill, and his government at the time, Australia, and to this day, had an interest in the TPP, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was this global free trade agreement that would have destroyed American industries boosted foreign industries like Australia and China, which Donald Trump, of course, was against, and thank goodness he was against it, because he likely saved the American economy by not ratifying that agreement that Australia wanted. So these countries, the Italians, the British, the Australians, even the Chinese, but the Chinese weren't involved in my story, but the British, the Italians, and the Australians were involved in my story, they all had interests in Clinton being president. So it's not beyond the pale to think that these countries were actively working with the Obama administration to hurt the Trump campaign and sabotage it, and they almost did.
So it's fair to say there that you think Downer was spying on you, right?
I am 100% certain that Downer was spying on me. And just to substantiate my contention of what I'm telling you and the listeners, I would recommend everyone read my testimony to Congress, which is now public, all 239 pages of it. It's a very quick read. And in this transcript, you'll see prominent members of Congress, like Congressman Mark Meadows and John Ratcliffe, asking me point blank, did the FBI or Mueller ever present to you or your legal team transcripts of your meeting with Alexander Downer or any other official? And I said no. And the reason they were asking me this is because I'm certain that Alexander Downer was recording the conversation. His behavior was very bizarre, and it seemed as if he was there to record me with either his phone or with a wire. And I'm pretty sure moving forward, as I stated, I would bet my reputation on it, that you're going to see that that's going to be revealed, and you're probably going to see that other transcripts exist from other informants who are targeting either myself, Flynn, or even Carter Page and others.
Well, let's move on to the next character, Stefan Halper, who supposedly was a Cambridge professor. How did he fit into all this, and do you think he was an FBI informant, or what else?
Well, he's a very interesting character. So Stefan Halper, he reached out to me in early September 2016 out of the blue, and he told me, hey, I'm a Cambridge professor, and I want to pay you some money to write about the energy business, which that's what I used to do for a living, and I want you to fly to London to meet with me. And I said, that's fine. I Googled him. I wasn't too concerned about him because he seemed to have held prominent positions in four U.S. administrations, and he was a Cambridge professor. I fly to London, and that's when I don't know if you remember that story in the New York Times last week about his other informant that was with him. He introduces me to this woman who was some sort of a CIA operative. and then Stefan Halper is there to basically spy on me and to understand the inner workings of the Trump campaign and record my conversation. Now, I have been told by very high-level sources that transcripts of this meeting exist, and they're probably going to be one of the first things that President Trump declassifies, likely next week, according to Laura Ingraham, who mentioned it on her show 2 days ago. So he was certainly a spy. He didn't just spy on me. He spied on Michael Flynn in 2015. He spied on Sam Clovis, who was another campaign associate. He spied on Carter Page. And he actually ingratiated himself within the Trump transition team and was in the running to be the U.S. ambassador to China. So whoever planted him as a mole in the campaign or the transition team wanted this person to be very close to the campaign and to the president himself to basically spy on the president should he have been elected. And that's why this character and his involvement in this entire Spygate story is so disturbing, and why I think we're going to learn a lot more about him moving forward and not just about me.
So this Azra Turk, who was supposedly his assistant, you met with her in a London bar. Everybody's heard about this in various television presentations. Tell us about those interactions that you had with her and whether you think she was some kind of a foreign agent, perhaps working with the CIA.
Yes, yes. I don't think she was FBI, and I've explained why. And even the New York Times demurred when they stated that she was FBI. They said we can't say who she was working for. She was a foreign agent. She was a Turkish national. She had a very heavy Turkish accent. Her tactics were to basically seduce me and to come on to me, something that the FBI doesn't allow. Of course, and I don't think the FBI trains its agents to basically touch the subject's hand or whatever she was trying to do with me. And so what I think was happening, considering that the operation was in London, where the FBI doesn't have jurisdiction but the CIA does, I think this was a dirty CIA op that was meant to basically try and have me slip up and say something that I had absolutely no information about. And that was about Trump and Russia, probably just to impress this honeypot. And I think that's what the point of why they brought her into the game and why she was being so flirty and why, they involved her. Because at the time, I was a younger guy. I'm not that old anymore still. And I was single, and they probably thought, oh, he would try and do something. And that's, I assume, why they pulled out all the stops. But fortunately, I kept my senses. And, I was just very suspicious about her right away, and I just kept my mouth shut about any questions she was asking me, because she just seemed immediately to me as some sort of agent and not a normal girl.
Okay, now you said that an Israeli-American businessman by the name of Charles Tawil, or Tawil, however you pronounce it, gave you $10,000 in cash, which is super mysterious. Now, how does he fit into the Mueller investigation? And you've said that you think it's important for the FBI to recover the $10,000. Explain why.
Yes. So a month after Mueller's team is interviewing me in January and February of 2017, I didn't know it at the time, but I learned it, of course, during the Mueller report, where he wrote that there were search warrants and warrants issued against me because of my significant ties to Israel, which I never understood how I could have had wiretaps issued against me by the Obama administration simply because I was a well-connected person in Israel. So that was very bizarre. So why did I mention that, just to put context into Charles Tawil? A month after the FBI comes to my house, this person, Charles Tawil, who I've never heard of in my life, connects with me. And he says, I would like to fly to Chicago and meet with you and discuss business. And I said to myself, well, okay. At that point, I was probably not going to be joining the administration, considering the FBI was harassing me for 3 months. So I said, okay, let me hear what this person has to say. And, I just felt very suspicious about this person. He was talking a lot in circles. He never made sense of what he really wanted me to do for him in terms of a business proposal. So, I Googled him and I saw that he was connected to the CIA actually in South Africa. If you simply Googled the name Charles Tawil, you can see that WikiLeaks has a profile about him as some sort of CIA person or CIA connected person. And, I kind of was hesitant. I didn't think too much. Then fast forward to the summer of 2017, I'm on vacation with my then girlfriend, now wife. And he comes to me in Greece, where I was on vacation, and he says, why don't you fly to Israel with me? And let's finalize a business agreement. And I never understood why he wanted me to fly to Israel until now it all makes sense that Mueller had been trying to frame me to make me look like some sort of Israeli agent, which I wasn't, of course. I go to Israel, and he says to me, here's a retainer for you, George. And I say, what retainer? And he pulls out $10,000 in cash. And he says, this is for you. And right away, I'm thinking I'm being set up. No person in their right mind pulls out $10,000 in cash and gives it to somebody without an agreement, without a bank account, or without a corporation or an LLC or something like that, okay? So I take the money and I say to myself, okay, I'm in a foreign government right now, in a foreign country. I know I'm being set up. What do I do with this money? I leave him the next day or then a couple days later, and I give the money to my lawyers in Greece, which it still remains to this day. And why this money is so important is because when I was flying back to America and I was arrested in this savage-like manner, the FBI agents were rummaging through my luggage looking for money. And I believe, and people in Congress and my lawyers currently believe, that that money was part of a sting operation and that this person was working with Mueller's team. So I'm right now in the process of hopefully delivering the $10,000 in cash I still have to the new investigators to trace it and to see where it came from. And if it indeed came from Bob Mueller's team, which Joe DiGenova and his wife Townsend, the two prominent D.C. attorneys, believe are marked the bills, then it's going to open up a huge can of worms for Bob Mueller, the FBI, and even probably Jim Comey.
Did you ask Tawil to take the money back? Did you try to give it back to him?
Yes. I told him after I was trying to basically try and understand why he gave me the money, and I kept telling him, what can I do for this money? How can I help you? And I saw that we weren't getting anywhere. I told him, look, I don't want your money anymore, because of course I'm not going to take somebody's money if we're not going to have a normal agreement. So it doesn't matter if it's $1 or $10,000. I would never do that. So I told him, I don't want your money. Come pick it up. And he was in Israel, and I was in Greece. So it's an hour flight. And he says, no, I'm not flying to Greece to pick it up, and I don't want the money. And then I said, well, I don't want your money, and I'm just going to leave it with my lawyer, and you can pick it up whenever you want. Now, why is the next thing he told me very strange and probably solidifies that this was an entrapment operation? He told me, why don't you fly to Cyprus and drop off the money for me? Now, Cyprus, at that moment, this is mid-June 2017, was in discussions actively with Andrew Weissman about money laundering cases and looking into Trump figures who were connected to Cyprus and that part of the world, which I was. So I believe if I had flown to Cyprus with his money, there'd be agents waiting to arrest me in Cyprus and probably extradite me back to the U.S. But I never went to Cyprus. I ended up going to Dulles, and I got arrested at Dulles for the same exact thing. So now that this $10,000 has become a front page story, and I know Charles Tawil, he's going around discrediting me and saying that he's lying and that I never set him up. I understand Charles Tawil is going to do that because, of course, it looks like he got caught in something. But I'm very confident that when this money is reviewed, it's going to lead to a sting operation, and it's going to be a very bad image for the FBI.
Tawel also said that claimed that you were desperate to work with him and that you never tried to give the money back. So it does sound very, very suspicious for sure.
You know, I answered that point. If I was so desperate to work for him, the last thing I would do is leave the money with a lawyer. I would have taken the money. Because I was so suspicious and I didn't want to work with him, I left the money with my lawyer and told him to pick it up. So I think this is going to be an interesting aspect of this investigation moving forward. Of course, I know Charles Tawel is going to try and say that this was nothing wrong and it's just a usual order of business to give $10,000 to people in cash, but it's not. And you and probably everyone listening to our program right now will understand that that's not normal. And something probably shady was going on here.
Why do you think Robert Mueller wanted to charge you as an unregistered agent of Israel? Would it have anything to do with Tawel, or what was that all about? What were your ties to Israel?
Well, the reason I believe that Tawel was an informant for them to frame me, to make me look like an agent, is because by the time the FBI came to my house for the first time in January of 2017, they were asking me about 80% about my ties to Israel, not about Russia, because I have no ties to Russia, as I explained in the beginning of this conversation. And I was, when I joined the Carson and the Trump campaigns and when I was working in Washington, I wasn't just randomly joining presidential campaigns. I was joining these campaigns because I was selling access to a very high-level network I had in the Middle East in general. I was the one that ended up actually brokering the meeting between Donald Trump and the Egyptian president at the UN General Assembly. That's something people don't understand. So when Donald Trump was meeting President Sisi at the UN General Assembly, that happened. And if people read my book, Deep State Target, you'll see how that meeting actually happened. It happened because I had connections in Athens who connected me to the Egyptians. And then, you know, I negotiated this meeting between Trump and Sisi. But the reason, back to your question of what those ties were, the reason I had those ties is because I was advising U.S. energy companies who were newly working in Israel and helping them produce a new discovery of oil and natural gas, which happened in 2010. So I was a pioneer, I guess, in many ways, and I was advising these companies. I was advising the Israeli government informally, of course. I was never paid a single dollar by any foreign government in my entire life, of how they should basically be working with the governments in that part of the world, how they should export their resources. And I think based on that, it put some sort. And then, of course, if you Google my name, and you'll see I wrote op-eds in the Jerusalem Post and Haaretz and some of these major Israeli newspapers. That likely puts a target on me, the way that illicit target, I should say, the way that a target was on Michael Flynn for his speech he gave at RT in Russia, because that's the only explanation I have. I don't understand what else the Obama administration would be spying on me and why the FBI would be executing search warrants on me for my ties to the Israelis, because I never took a dollar from Israel. I was simply a supporter of the U.S.-Israel relationship, probably like about 90% of Americans are. And I was advising them just at a very different level than the usual analyst does. But for me to be targeted for that, I think is crazy. And I wouldn't be surprised if there was a FISA warrant issued on me as well. And we'll see what happens if that's revealed.
You know, President Trump has repeatedly said that he intends to declassify all documents related to the Russian collusion investigation. But
yes,
so far, he's not done so. So what documents would you personally like to see the president declassify that are really important from your standpoint?
What's very important for the president to declassify from my standpoint is the following. The Carter Page FISA, and then let me explain why. In April 2017, I was approached by ABC News and a major newspaper in this country, and they told me that they had information that there was a FISA warrant issued on me, and I was dumbfounded. I couldn't understand what was happening. And the reason that they reached out to me in April of 2017 is because that's when the Carter Page unredacted FISA was sent to the New York Times. So I think that my name is in Carter Page's FISA. There probably was some sort of FISA on me. That's why I want that to be declassified? Because if there was a FISA on me, I want to know exactly why there was one. The second thing I want to know, and the president should declassify, is the names and the handlers of all the informants that were thrown at the Trump campaign, including Joseph Mifsud, Stefan Halper, Alexander Downer, and likely others who might have actually even been spies within the campaign. There have been rumors that there were actually spies embedded within the campaign itself. So I want the president to declassify so we get the names of those people. And the last thing I think the president needs to do is declassify the involvement of foreign governments in spying on Trump campaign associates, including the UK and Australia. In about 5 months ago, when President Trump announced that he was going to declassify the FISA warrants, the British and the Australians called him and begged him not to declassify it. So clearly, those countries are up to their neck in colluding with the Obama administration and trying to harm the Trump campaign. And I think the president, if he wants to dignify America and have it respected the way he says he wants it to be respected, he needs to, you know, cast light on all of these bad actors. He needs to show the American public who was doing wrong against him and his team, and to assure that it never happens again. And if that exposes informants, foreign governments, or methods and tactics, which of course were illegally obtained for political purposes, he needs to do it. And that's what I think he's going to reveal when he declassifies everything, and what I think are the most important things.
I always have to end these interviews about this Russian collusion investigation with John Brennan, because it just, some people rub you wrong. And from the beginning, if I hadn't known anything about Brennan, I just said, this guy is dirty for sure, up to his ears. So I want to know how deeply involved you think Brennan was. And then after that, you can go move on to our other friends, Comey and Clapper, regarding criminal liability. What's your take?
I think in my case, I'm not too familiar with the other people's cases. Due to the foreign nature of my case, and considering I was living in London and I was traveling extensively in Europe and the Middle East while I was on the campaign as a foreign policy advisor and meeting foreign government officials constantly as part of my job duties, I think that Brennan was running the show in targeting me. I don't think it was the FBI. I think the FBI were following Brennan's lead, and then they probably were duped into casting some sort of search warrant on me that the CIA couldn't. But Brennan, in my case, I think he was the one that was prodding the UK, Australia, Italy, which we now know Italy was involved in the Joseph Mifsud story. And I explained that in my book of the Italian officials who connected me with Mifsud. I think Brennan was the kingpin behind this. And Brennan, I don't think, was doing it on his own. Because when you're involving foreign governments, especially NATO members like Italy, the UK is, and Australia, which is part of the Five Eye spy system, it might have led to Obama himself. So that's what I think Brennan was up to. I think he was the one that is probably going to be the most implicated in this scandal, because people like Christopher Steele as well is a foreign agent. And now it looks like Jim Comey is saying that Brennan was the one pushing the Steele dossier as well. So you have Brennan prodding foreign governments to spy on us, and then you have him also prodding for the Steele dossier to be part of the FISA warrant. So it looks like Brennan is probably going to be implicated in this, and I don't know to what extent, but it sounds to me like it's part of a conspiracy.
Yes, and of course, Brennan is saying Comey's the one that wanted it included. What exactly did Mueller claim you lied about, just so our people will have that clear in their minds? And did you agree with him on that?
Imagine you're 29 years old, like I was at the time. You have the federal government zeroing in on you to take down a president, which is exactly what was happening. And your resources are, you know, limited because you're just basically coming into your career in many ways. And all of a sudden, you are arrested. You don't understand why you're arrested. It's a very confusing moment in America at that time. This is 2017, where obviously the media was feeding this Russia hysteria. And the Mueller team is saying to you that you are meeting with a Russian agent, and he's talking about emails with you, and you lied about when you met him. And if you don't plead to guilty to that, we're going to charge you with acting as an Israeli agent and all this other nonsense, which, of course, I didn't have $1 million to go to trial to fight. So what they charged me with, and it's searchable right now for anyone who's interested, they charged me with misremembering when I met Joseph Mifsud. I said that I met him before I joined the Trump campaign, and then they said, no, you were part of the Trump campaign when you met him. So just to be clear, if the FBI and these political appointees, because I call the Mueller team a political appointed team, go after you, they'll try and indict you on anything. And basically, that's what they got me for, is not remembering when I met Joseph Mifsud, and they said I lied, and it hurt their investigation. So it just goes to show the extent that these people went to get a couple scalps in against Trump. But unfortunately for them, I think the majority of Americans now know that this wasn't a big witch hunt, and it's probably emboldened the president to have American support behind launching these new investigations, which, of course, Americans need to be behind for them to be, substantive.
Last point, and it's most important one, and it's just your personal opinion, but you have been on the inside in the way you described. What role do you think Barack Obama played in all this? Because they're always talking about how high up this is going to go, the White House. But you don't hear too many people mentioning the name Barack Obama. I have my own thoughts about it. I'll keep to myself right now. I want to hear from your standpoint where you think Barack Obama is in all this. Did he understand all of it? Did he direct it? Was he not involved? What do you think?
I think Barack Obama was looking after his legacy. And this is just my opinion, and I think I'm right. He understood that people like Bernie Sanders were never going to promote his agenda the way Hillary would have. That's why people stated that Hillary's presidency would have meant Barack Obama's third and fourth term. That was a very common theme, if you remember. And clearly Obama had a he seemed very insecure about himself, and he felt, even when he said it himself in the new book, I think, that's come out recently, that when Donald Trump was elected president, he felt that America betrayed him, meaning Barack Obama.
Right.
So here, the point I'm trying to make is, I think that Obama was keen on actually running this operation against not only the Trump campaign, but probably spying on other campaigns and even Bernie Sanders' campaign, for one reason and one reason only, and that was to assure that Hillary would win, and she would then continue his legacy of whatever he was promoting that caused disarray and chaos in this country for 8 years, where unemployment was skyrocketing, you had social issues, and just America wasn't America anymore for 8 years under Obama. And I think that's why he wanted to assure that Hillary would win, and he did everything in his power to assure it by playing dirty. And by playing dirty, that's what part of this conversation with you has been for the last hour, is doing what he did. So when you ask me, was he the one leading it? Did he know everything? I actually think he and Brennan initiated it. And then I also believe that they brought Comey in along for the ride, because the FBI are the ones who can go in front of a FISA court. They are the ones that can prosecute. They are the ones that could put people in jail, and that's why the FBI ended up getting involved. They were the henchmen, but the two brains behind it, I think, were Brennan and Obama. So I believe that Obama started it, and the reason he did it was not for America's interests. It was for his own arrogance and his own legacy that he wanted to prolong, and it backfired on him. Luckily, President Trump won, and we don't have a third and fourth term of Obama, because I think he was the worst president in history.
By the way, the word he used, I believe, was insult. He's so arrogant that he took it as a personal insult. Hillary wasn't elected. If you want to be certain you're going to be elected or reelected, hope and pray that Obama endorses the opposing candidate. He did it with Hillary. He did it with the gal in Georgia. He's the kiss of death.
I agree with you. And, you're absolutely right. And that's why maybe he hasn't endorsed anybody, because they don't want his endorsement. And he probably is hiring a very robust legal team right now, like Brendan and Comey already have. So we'll wait and see. But you're absolutely right. People are probably running for the hills and are scared to death of Obama's endorsement, or him even talking on their behalf once on any campaign trail. So he did it to himself. He only has himself to blame.
Exactly. Well, he wanted to fundamentally change America. And I've always said, I give him credit for really trying real hard. And the only reason that he failed is because I see him as, contrary to what the media wants you to think, smartest guy in the room. I see him as probably the dumbest guy in the room, and extremely lazy in his own arrogance, I think, got in his way, or he would have finished the job. And I think somebody from above sent Trump along to undo and reverse all the things Obama did. That's my own take. But, George, this is all pretty remarkable stuff. It's kind of like reading a spy novel. I can't wait till the movie comes out. And speaking of spy novels, for those who would like to delve into it more deeply, I would encourage you to get a copy of George Papadopoulos' best-selling book, Deep State Target, How I Got Caught in the Crosshairs of the Plot to Bring Down President Trump. So, George, I want to thank you for sharing your story with us today. And as things continue to unfold, perhaps we can do an update down the road.
Absolutely. I'd be very happy to do it. I enjoyed this thoroughly, and thank you very much for having me.